Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The theme of the broadcast today, somebody else reading your mail. The Chinese government spying on American companies, the American government spying on you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday today, my calendar says it's the 19th day of May. Great, as always, to have you with us. It has been long suspected, widely assumed, I think you might fairly say, that the Chinese government takes a keen interest in the inner workings of some of the biggest of American companies. Today, the Attorney General of the United States came right out and said so. A federal grand jury has indicted five members of the Chinese Army for, and this is a quote from the Justice Department, targeting the U.S. private sector for commercial advantage. Cyber hacking is the crime, to be precise. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz is in Shanghai. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
Interesting news, this. Lots of bits to take apart. The first one that hit me was that it's the Chinese Army again that's being named in these indictments.
Right. Yeah. A little more than a year ago, we learned that a single unit of China's People's Liberation Army, also known here as the PLA, located actually down the street from here in Shanghai, had hacked into dozens of big U.S. companies, stealing reams of intellectual property and technology. But this news and the implications of all this were sort of cut short because right after this was discovered last year, a former NSA employee named Edward Snowden released what amounted to a nuclear bomb on the U.S. intelligence community, showing that the NSA was operating a massive spying operation.
Yeah, the Snowden bit we'll get to in a second. I do want to, though, ask you what we can learn from the companies that the PLA, according to the U.S. government, is targeting. Westinghouse, U.S. Steel, Alcoa,
right.
These are commodities producers. They're high-profile companies. What do you take from this?
Yeah, you know, according to the charges announced this morning, this grand jury in Pittsburgh accused five individuals with hacking into, like you said, a nuclear power plant, a solar company, among other targets. Now, it's important to understand that they were allegedly hacking into these companies 3 or 4 years ago. And at that time, China had just announced it was going to build dozens of nuclear power plants across the country. And of course, the U.S. has a lot of experience building nuclear power plants, so it could be reasonably assumed that China was cutting and copying plans from the U.S. for their nuclear power plants. At that same time, China was also becoming the world's largest solar panel manufacturer, and there was this anti-dumping complaint that was filed in the WTO from the U.S. against China. So it can also be assumed that China was probably looking to gain the upper hand in preparing for that particular case when it hacked into the U.S. solar company to find pricing information.
About Snowden and the NSA, safe to say that the U.S. is probably doing similar things over there?
Well, I think for years the U.S. has made the argument that the NSA doesn't snoop on individuals and companies to steal technology. It does so in order to protect the safety of the United States. And you can probably guess how this argument stands up here in China. The Chinese, of course, scoff at this rationale, but I think it's worth noting that China has stolen tons of data and technology from foreign companies, and these charges are just the tip of the iceberg.
Give me your sense, Rob, in the long-term economic picture. Is this a bump in the road, or is it a bigger deal?
Well, I do think it's a big problem, but I also think that the NSA revelations make it very difficult for the U.S. to hold the high ground on what is a very important international issue. That said, will this stop American companies from operating and making money in China? No. The companies who had been hacked last year were too scared to even complain about having their technology stolen by the Chinese because they were scared of upsetting one of their most important global markets. Unless U.S. companies start standing up for themselves and start publicly complaining about this, you know, I think the hacking is probably going to continue for quite a while.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Guy.
Back home today, down at the lower end of the Isle of Manhattan. Fairly quiet day. Truth be told, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Corporate consolidation news we've all been waiting for dropped over the weekend. AT&T is indeed going to buy DirecTV for $48.5 billion, and with it we'll get as part of the deal, DirecTV's 20-some-odd million customers. That is, of course, pending approval from federal regulators. Regulators who, I am obliged to add, are already up to their elbows sorting out a different telecommunications merger, the one between Comcast and Time Warner. So, Marketplace's David Gura walks us through what's in this deal and how AT&T is going to try to sell it to regulators.
First, the deal. To understand what this is all about, you have to understand what's happening in the market. Telecom analysts say this has to do with network efficiency and with things like capacity and scale.
Big fish are swallowing small fish.
Reed Hunt is the former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission.
And if you want to avoid being swallowed, you need to be a bigger and bigger fish.
AT&T has wanted to grow. It's been angling for an acquisition for a while. Last year, regulators rejected its bid to buy T-Mobile. That was one wireless company trying to acquire another wireless company.
I think AT&T now has a deal it can close.
Because this is a wireless company trying to buy a satellite service provider, Hunt says. So let's unpack that. AT&T would get an existing customer base, a big one. Rob Frieden teaches telecom law at Penn State.
And there's something to be said for having 26 million additional customers to pitch the variety of services that AT&T can now bundle and package.
Customers willing to pay for exclusive content.
Mike, come on over. The Bears are on.
We don't get that game here with cable.
Like DirecTV's NFL Sunday Ticket. Those tens of millions of customers would also come in handy for another reason, according to Todd Rethemeyer, who's with Hudson Square.
It helps you to strike a better deal with those content providers.
So AT&T wants new customers to offer phone service, internet service, and TV. Sound familiar? Well, that's something Comcast has pioneered, and the FCC and the Justice Department will consider this merger in the context of Comcast's offer to buy Time Warner Cable. But Rethemeyer says AT&T has this defense.
In the pay TV business, AT&T is a relatively small player today.
Rethemeyer and others say they don't expect this deal will hit a hurdle here in Washington. And there's this other point raised by Harold Furchtgott Roth. He used to be an FCC commissioner.
The market landscape is changing with or without these mergers.
Not only has the market started to change, but also the way video services are delivered. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Rob Schmitz and I were talking a little bit about Edward Snowden up at the top of the program and how he figures into the international cyber espionage dynamic. Mr. Snowden, of course, also looms large in the domestic discussion as well. His revelations are at the root of a new Frontline documentary that airs tomorrow night about the NSA and American companies and what both of them know about us. Martin Smith is the correspondent on the film. It's called United States of Secrets, Privacy Lost. Martin, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
You start us with Edward Snowden. You talk to Glenn Greenwald. You talk to some people at the NSA. You talk to a whole bunch of folks. And then you get into the corporate aspect of this thing, which is for me the most interesting part of it, to be honest with you. And you say about halfway, three quarters of the way through this film, that if Google and all the other companies out there involved in this didn't know that this was coming, they simply weren't paying attention. And you play this clip from President Bush in 2001, right after the attacks, in which he says, in essence, we're going to check everything.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the internet, and cell phones.
Immediately after 9/11, the companies had been warned.
They will be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology.
And here we are today.
Yeah, it was kind of remarkable to go back and in the context of what we now know to listen to what President Bush was then saying. You know, when you look at that in today's context, it was all laid out. The companies clearly had to know. And in fact, we talked to some insiders, former a fellow from Google, who said that, you know, he had worried for a long time that with their amassing all this information, that government would be coming right along.
Yeah, but the other thing that becomes clear, and one of the people you talked to actually says this, when this whole thing broke and it became clear how into Google's system and everybody else's system, the NSA was, Google viewed it as, and this is a quote, a betrayal of the relationship.
Well, there were a couple of different kinds of things that the NSA was into. One was an upfront program that allowed them to gain access to information that they requested. But there was also breaking into their fiber optic lines running between data centers that the NSA was just tapping into without the companies having any knowledge. That was a surprise to them. That's the betrayal that's being referred to.
You know, it's tempting to ask why companies and then eventually the government can't just stop with this surveillance stuff, either surveillance for surveillance's sake or surveillance for advertisement's sake. But fundamentally, it's the business model now.
Well, that there was a choice in the late 90s. If you remember, you used to have to go to a store and buy a web browser and pay money for it.
Yeah.
That all went away with the advertising model when Sergey Brin and Larry Page of Google put together their search engine. That could have been a service that you paid for, but instead it was a free service, much like other products that they rolled out, Gmail. All these things are so-called free, but what we're giving in return is access to our personal data.
This is, in its fundamental essence, I suppose, it's a story about trust and willingness to believe. And I guess the question that comes out of it is, at the end of the day, knowing what we know now or think we know now about the NSA and what it does with corporate assistance and sometimes without, is that trust in corporate America, in government America, is it ruptured irretrievably, do you think?
That's going to be a case-by-case basis. People are going to ask themselves questions about just how much information they want to put out there. Some people seem not to mind. I think others of us haven't really thought about or don't know exactly what it is that we're giving up and where that information can go. And never before in history has so much information, personal information, information that could be used to blackmail people, been available both to corporations and to government.
It's a film called United States of Secrets Privacy Lost that airs tomorrow night on PBS. It is another one from Martin Smith and Frontline. Martin, thanks very much.
Kai, thank you.
Coming up,
I think we're at the beginning now of what could be another renaissance.
The investor, the motorcycle designer, and the future of American craftsmanship. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On a Monday, the Dow Industrial's up 20 points, about a 10%, ended at 16,511 did the blue chips. The NASDAQ rose 35 points, that is 0.8%, 41.25 there. The S&P 500 added 7 points, about a 3%. Finished things at 1885. One deal was rejected today. Another got a green light with opposite results. AstraZeneca rejected what Pfizer said was its last, best, and final offer, 117 billion American simoleons. Pfizer shares fizzed up about a 0.5% on that. AT&T, as we told you, said it's buying DirecTV. AT&T shares off 1%. DirecTV, though, fell even more, about 1.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.54%. And wait, what's the name of this show?
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. On this day in 1932, Amelia Earhart became the first to fly solo across the Atlantic. In Washington, a Senate committee will hold a roundtable on economic security for working women. And First Lady Michelle Obama and the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities will hold the first ever White House talent show. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The price of your daily cup of joe might soon be ticking up a couple of cents. There's apparently a fungus spreading through coffee fields in Central and South America. It's known as Roya, or coffee rust. The Agency for International Development, USAID, is expected to team up with academics to help figure out a solution. But in the meanwhile, what for us would just mean a price increase could wipe out small coffee farmers. Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
The fungus, which first shows as pale yellow spots, infects the leaves of coffee plants. It has caused an estimated $1 billion in damage so far. Jonathan Rosenthal, executive director of Cooperative Coffees, saw it in Honduras.
entire fields have just been devastated by the rust, and the trees have turned into skeletons, almost like a ghost town.
Coffee keeps hundreds of thousands of farmers and harvesters in Central and South America out of poverty. Rajiv Shah is the administrator of USAID, which through its Feed the Future program connects coffee growers
to companies like Starbucks and Peet's who can buy their coffee at relatively high prices. And we've seen in some cases incomes have gone up to 300%.
Shah says the blight has affected around 500,000 families who are vulnerable to security problems caused by drug traffickers and gangs.
They prey upon communities that are poor, where lots of children are hungry, and they offer them an illicit income opportunity by producing drugs and selling drugs or being engaged in other activities.
Lindsay Bolger, VP of coffee sourcing for Keurig Green Mountain, says there are fungicides that can combat the rust, but
the fungicide requires investment. The tools used to apply the fungicide require an investment. In some cases, these farmers just don't have the resources that they need.
Many other small farms are strictly organic, and fungicides aren't an option. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Ten years ago, a guy by the name of J.T. Nesbitt was one of the top motorcycle designers in the world. His picture was on the cover of magazines. Celebrities were buying his bikes. But in 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the company that was building J.T.'s designs, Confederate Motorcycles, was pretty much wiped out. 7 years later, his career still hadn't recovered. He was about to take a job waiting tables when a stranger showed up on his doorstep. So with a story of entrepreneurship, obsession, and opportunity as well, here's Marketplace's David Weinberg.
The stranger was a fan of JT's work. He wanted to see the latest motorcycles that JT had designed. But when he arrived at the shop, JT explained that he hadn't designed a bike in 7 years, and he was broke.
He looks around the shop, and he says, "Man, let's go get a drink, man. Can I buy you a drink?" I said, "Sure."
That's JT. After giving the stranger a tour, they took a walk down Decatur Street to a bar called Molly's.
So he sits me down, and he asked me this question. He said, "What would you do if you could do anything?"
I just honestly wanted to know.
And this is a stranger, Jim Jacoby.
And I think he was momentarily dumbfounded because nobody had asked him that. But strangely, as if it were rehearsed, he had his notebook with him.
I always carry my sketchbook with me, always.
And that prompted him to say, "Well, on your grandmother's eyeballs, I swear that you'll never show anybody anything like this." And he pulled out the sketchbook.
JT and Jim are opposites in many ways. Jim loves technology. He thinks it can be used to better mankind. JT shuns most modern conveniences. He doesn't have a phone that can text. Jim is soft-spoken, an introvert.
And even having a conversation like this is very much outside of what I would find him comfortable.
JT can be blunt and abrasive.
"Dude, that's a stupid question."
But one trait they share is obsessiveness.
"This is the only thing that I think about and the only thing that I've thought about for the past 8 years.
Jim says he asked to see JT's sketchbook simply out of curiosity. What he saw were the drawings of a bizarre-looking motorcycle. But the more he thought about them, the more he began to see the motorcycle as a solution to a much bigger problem: the decline of industrial design and craftsmanship in America.
It's unacceptable that somebody like JT would be sitting here waiting, unable to do what he's capable of doing. And if we don't capture this in people like JT and many other incredibly talented people who work with their hands first and then transfer things to computer and otherwise, we'll have lost it.
Jim Jacoby is a successful entrepreneur. He started a company in 2001 called Manifest Digital. It builds websites and does social marketing for large corporations like McDonald's. Jim built it from nothing and had 140 employees working for him. But he was starting to have doubts about the life he'd built around his company.
A company that needed to be profit-driven and needed to hit certain numbers and so on. And I was trying to solve for saving the world. Those two things are hard to square.
The meeting with JT pushed him over the edge. He made the decision to quit the company he founded. And then he took his life savings and handed it over to JT so he can build three prototypes of the motorcycle. This motorcycle commission is just the beginning of Jim's plan to revive American craftsmanship.
The goal is to separate, again, the drive for profit from the act of designing.
In other words, to remove the corporate constraints that normally hinder industrial designers. Things like keeping the cost of materials down and designing for mass appeal. One of the reasons JT was on the verge of going back to being a waiter is that he's unwilling to compromise.
If Jim hadn't shown up, I would be serving you lunch. And that's okay, man. There's honor in that. I'd rather be the guy serving you lunch than a guy who's building a compromised motorcycle for mass consumption.
Jim has not given JT any design restrictions for this motorcycle,
which frees me up to do pure design, pure art.
Together, JT and Jim are trying to create a new type of patronage system. They compare it to the Medicis, the wealthy banking family that gave birth to the Italian Renaissance. They call this system the ADMCI, American Design and Mastercraft Initiative.
I think we're at the beginning now of what could be another Renaissance. You have, you know, more money sitting on the sidelines through private equity and venture capital and in just business profits than has ever existed. My goal is to lead through example and inspiration to say, let's believe in great craftsmen first, put that money to work with them, and the byproduct of what they produce will create all kinds of other business opportunities.
We'll get to those other business opportunities in a minute, but to understand them, it'll help to know how the ADMCI is structured. It's made up of three parts. One of them is a nonprofit.
The ADMCI Master Practitioner Foundation.
This nonprofit will apply for grants and, most importantly, seek out wealthy donors or patrons. JT is building three prototypes of the motorcycle. When they are finished, the ADMCI will likely sell them for about $250,000 each. But whoever buys one won't own it outright. They'll be more like stewards of the motorcycle. In the same way an art collector might purchase a painting that has to be on display in public, the motorcycle may be part of a traveling museum exhibit.
Going to art and design museums and to design schools around the country, to corporate centers, and really start to put this message out there.
David Lenk is an industrial design expert. He also designs museum exhibits for a living.
And really what I do is tell stories in 3D.
David thinks the ADMCI could help reverse the decline of industrial design and manufacturing in America.
You can walk through any flea market aisle today, anywhere in the country, and find, you know, a Sunbeam-wearing blender or an Emerson fan or an old Bakelite Zenith radio from the late 40s. And not only do they look good, they probably still work.
For the best electric appliances made, look for the mark of quality.
But things started to change in the 50s.
Harvard MBA grads started fanning out, you know, evangelizing planned obsolescence, and finance suddenly became more important than corporate traditions of design or quality. And, you know, by the mid-60s, it was all gone, and you know, it's just junk.
David believes that if the ADMCI's first commission is a success, if it makes a big enough splash, it could be a model for a new way to fund innovation and design. An alternative to traditional investment models that are profit-driven.
I see a decentralization occurring. I see sort of an anti, and when I mean anti-corporate, I mean structures that are like virtual teams, you know, suppliers that come together to support efforts that will allow individuals with ideas such as J.T. Nesbitt to produce.
And David's involvement in this project happened entirely by chance.
I'm not a drinker. I don't spend a lot of time in bars, and that's exactly where we were introduced.
Nearly 2 years after JT first showed Jim his sketchbook at Molly's, the two of them were back at the same bar in their usual spot when David Lenk happened to sit next to them.
Within, I think, two sentences, we were talking about, you know, French coachwork of the 1930s.
And then JT told David about his motorcycle prototype, which by this point was nearly complete. It was in his shop just a few blocks away.
The conversation ended with an invitation to visit his shop that Saturday. But nothing could have prepared me for, you know, what I saw there.
Tomorrow on Marketplace, we'll air part two of this story. We'll take a trip to JT's shop to get a look at the motorcycle. In New Orleans, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a quick follow-up to the story on Friday about that $35 million fine General Motors is going to pay for not telling the truth about its ignition switch problems. As part of the document dump related to that case, there is a PowerPoint presentation for engineers about how to describe the recall process in memos, including words never to use, such as grenade-like, Kevorkian-esque, widowmaker, and rolling sarcophagus. So now you know. Don't write that down. All right. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow up about 20 points, 1/10%. The NASDAQ up 35 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 put on 7 points, 0.33%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you right back here tomorrow, everybody. All right? This is APM.